Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been, and it always will be.
Okay, welcome to White Line Fever, episode 70. And our guest is a man, a blast from the distant past for me, but also he's got a lot going on at the moment. It's Craig Songrady from BB Steel. How are you, Craig?
Hey, Steve, how are you doing?
Good. It's been a while since we spoke on the record anyway. A long time.
Yeah, it has. It's been a long time. It's when, you know, dinosaurs ruled the earth. Rock, dude. When the rock was God.
It actually makes it really easy to come up with the first question, which is, where have you been the last 25 years?
Well, been around, I think, had a bit of a hiatus. What happened is, in around about 94, when Kurt Cobain came up with, you know, his the grunge and the whole Seattle sound came about, it was death, instant death for us guys, the hair farmers, you know, and the guys that wanted to play rock. And the record company looked at us like, you know, overnight, like we're an old Holden. So we were like, oh, okay, what do we do now? So I came back to Adelaide because I'm originally from Adelaide. I left Adelaide as a 17-year-old to go to Sydney way back and got, you know, the first deal with Boss through Warners and RCA. But I come back to Adelaide and, you know, I didn't know what to do. We did a couple of shows here. They were okay, but it wasn't like the old days, you know. There were kids out there now wanting to wear baggy pants, wear their cap backwards, and it was a whole new world, and I was not going to stick on a pair of baggy pants and stick my baseball cap backwards and try and be something that we weren't. So it was like basically went and helped my brother-in-law build houses for about 2-3 years. And then I got a phone call from John Brommel, who was the managing director from Warner Brothers. He was like my mentor. He was like my second dad, that guy. Anyway, he said, Craig, look, rock's kind of coming back in a way, and I think you should think about doing another album, but don't make it too heavy. Because, and I listened to him, but don't make it too heavy. Just make it you, trying to evolve and make it rock. And I said, you know what, John, I'm gonna get into it. I've got to get the vibe back because, you know, it's like the rock industry back then. It was a school of hard knocks. You know, we were doing 5, sometimes 7 nights a week on the road, just gigging, and it was pretty hard because I was a very young father and. You know, I was always away. And so we kind of, you know, crisscrossed the country. And, so went to America, I think we did for a little while. And things were looking fantastic until the grunge kind of hit us. So anyway, I've got this new record. I thought, well, we can't make one real quick. And, you've got to get the finances to make a decent album. So slowly chipped away at it in around about after 2000. And what we got is the new album, Resurrection, which was released originally as a, well, we put it out there as a, like a demo, production demo, promo demo, and we gave it to a label that wanted to hear it, and they ended up taking it without our permission and stuck it out there. And I won't mention the label, it was a Sydney label, and we spent the next 3 years getting it pulled down because it was on porn sites. There was 15,000 downloads on a porn site of a song, and yet this label said, oh, we didn't make much money out of that. But so it was like, oh, here we go again. Welcome to the music industry. So we had to pull it and not do anything with it, and all our artwork and everything, we had to redo it. And what I did is decided to remix, redo some guitars because it was a bit light on for me, and we went into the studio that I built, which is an amazing studio downstairs. It's got an old Neve console, very similar to the one that Dave Grohl used on that movie. Dave Grohl movie.
Mm-hmm.
What's that one?
You mean Sonic Highways, yeah?
Sonic Highway, yeah, it's a Neve. So I restored a Neve. It took another 2 years. So then we finally got down to it with Peter Blyton and myself. Pete's been a producer around for many years in Sydney. And, we started working on it and finished it. Did the artwork again with a gentleman from Mexico City called Hector Pineda, who's a surrealist artist. And it's great because he was into B.B. Steele and the second album way back in Mexico. And he just said, I'd love to, I've been a fan forever. So he did all the inlays and we did it's a really great cover. You've seen the cover, you would have.
I have. Who's the model on the front?
Well, that's actually a Mexican woman. Right. I don't know her name, but it's pretty hot. I didn't know where to go with that. I thought everyone says tits and bum still, so I thought, I'll stick a bum on the front of the cover. you got to do crazy things sometimes. But we've done a few shows. We had a great lineup with a couple of Sydney guys, and gigs are few and far between, and that kind of lost the vibe and. Went their ways, which was great, and they're still great guys, still great friends. But I've got another lineup here, which is absolutely smoking, absolutely on fire. I got Steve Williams on guitar, one of the guitarists. You know Steve Williams?
Yeah, the name rings a
bell. Played with John Lord. He's played with. He was in a big pop band in Australia way back in the late '80s, and called Wawanee.
Oh, right,
and. He's actually a really hot, smoking rock player, very Hendrix-influenced. He's got a really heavy right hand and a left hand, great rhythm hand, but his lead playing is just very strong, very animal. And so I got him and I got a young dude who looks like Kurt Cobain, which makes me laugh every time I look at him. But he's a cool, surfy dude, plays rock really hard. Influenced by guys like Blackmore and Page. And, he's a youngish guy. He's in his late 20s, but just add new blood. Great
okay,
drummer.
So let's hear a song, eh? I think it's probably... do you want to pick a song off Resurrection, which you referred to as the third album, but you're including Boss as well, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah, I am. I do it because the name changed. We had to change it. Well, right in the turn of 89 about that time, our record company said, look, we're getting a few complaints about Boss, the Sex Pedal people, Boss Apparel, from America, Boss, people are thinking you're the backup band for Bruce Springsteen, and our manager at the time, which was Richard Wilkins, back in the Boss days, when people would say, oh, is that Bruce's band? And he'd say, yeah. And like I said before, we were getting 5 and 10 grand guarantees as 18-year-olds going, how are you doing this? Because, most bands were getting $200.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because we'd rock up to a venue, especially we're talking regionals, and they'd go, where's the Boss? And we're that. And they'd look at us cross-eyed, and they go, no, it was Bruce. I said, no, Bruce. And now we got it. We said, no, Bruce isn't with us. We're the backup band. So it got a bit embarrassing, So we just basically, it was really Spinal Tap, total Spinal Tap. It was like they put on a big spread for us, and when they realised we're not them, it was like we've just put on this big spread for the Boss, and he's not here,
Which song should we play?
Given the opening track.
Waiting for you.
Hi, it's Craig from BB Steel. Great to be on White Lion Fever with Steve Massacord. Hope to see you out in the gig soon.
So, welcome back to White Lion Fever, episode 70. Sorry, it's been a while coming. We haven't done an episode since the 9s. Before I introduce our guest for the talking part of the program, you've got to mention WLF Podcast on Twitter and also White Lion Fever on Facebook. And please come and join whitelionfever.ning.com. And we are here at Headingley. I'm here with Phil Kaplan from 4020. And we're waiting for Leeds to play Huddersfield. But we're going to talk about the World Club Series. How are you, Phil?
I'm fine. Thank you for asking. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, we're back to sort of domestic competition now. What did you think of the World Club Series?
I loved it. I mean, I think a phrase that I used, having been involved in some of the build-up and going to the matches, was rugby league grew up in this country for that week. I think that we were an adult sport. We were featured in magazines. There were film premieres. There were dinners. It felt as though we were hitting avenues that rugby league in this country doesn't normally get to. And the whole idea in that grounds are going to be full to watch players that we don't see regularly just caught the imagination. And yeah, it might have taken 120 years, but we felt a little bit more like a big sport.
Now, because of the ambient noise, I'm going to flip this around and hope it doesn't, they say in the business, it doesn't pop. There's not a lot of distortion. So apologies, listeners, if there is. But I suppose at the start of the week, I had doubts that it was going to break out of the normal sort of sphere of rugby league coverage, but you feel it did by the end of the week.
I think a lot of that was down to Russell Crowe, and we shouldn't underestimate the influence that building a lot of the media around him had in this country. And you know, taglines like he preferred Langtree Park to the Oscars just got the national coverage that we don't normally get. To give you an example, the BBC National News late on Sunday night, after Souths had beat St Helens, had a rugby league feature. Well, that would never have happened, but the lead into it was where Russell Crowe had been that night, and there was clippers of him doing interviews on the pitch. So yes, we got away with whatever the results may have been, with the fact that we actually got a profile for the sport. And yeah, that was partly down to that he had a film to sell, but he went on a programme called The Last Leg with Adam Hills and got them to come to the matches, so they tweeted about it. And again, I just think it was something that we don't normally see over here. Rugby league was up the sporting agenda when it's been slipping down.
Does the gulf in the salary caps mean that there's a limited time span for the concept as it is now?
I'm not sure. I think what I would say from watching these teams regularly over here is that all of the English teams were a little bit down on the best we've seen in Super League. So Warrington were maybe 5% down. There were a couple of uncharacteristic errors by players you wouldn't normally expect. The most obvious one being John Monaghan would have scored that try every week in Super League. But, you know, maybe he was in awe of the covering defence coming over and dropped it. But uncharacteristic. Wigan were scrappers on Saturday night. They deserve enormous credit for staying in the game for so long, but they didn't ever look like they were going to win it. They were just a little bit down from what we see in Super League week to week. And Saints, again, three times in the first half they were prevented from putting the ball down over the line. I think in Super League they'd have scored most, if not all, of those tries. Those little margins where the Super League teams weren't quite up to it meant that we didn't see the very best of them. But I'd take you back to a match at Headingley in 2012 when Leeds played Manly, and Leeds were at the top of their game and they beat Manly. So I don't think we can read too much into that. I think the salary cap is an issue, but it wasn't the reason why the teams lost this weekend.
In 10 or 20 or 30 years, God willing, we're both still around, will we see a fully integrated competition between the two leagues?
It's an interesting concept, and I think the good thing is we're talking about it. I mean, I think you started it many, many years ago about, you know, maybe having a team based in Perth of all British players. Then that was taken on, and maybe there should be a team that's based in England playing in an NRL. Then we had Russell Crowe saying it should be the top four from each division playing in a separate competition. I think now you again are among the people that proposed the idea of maybe an integrated competition. Why not think about it? I mean, the thing that's always struck me is that we've only got about 800 players that are paid by the sport on a full-time basis in both hemispheres. We need to expand that. We'll do that by taking the sport to new markets, and this may be a product to do that. You could imagine that this World Club series or championship or whatever it's going to be called in the future, it could become a bit of a travelling circus, and that could get more and more people in more countries involved in wanting to be part of the sport.
What about in the immediate future, Phil? What do you see, the same again next year, or have you got any whispers that it'll be fine-tuned in any way?
I think it'll still be over here. I think that's for certain. I'm pretty sure it'll be three clubs, and the idea would be to move to four as soon as possible. I think the other thing that perhaps the organisers are looking to do is maybe move in the direction where we can bring Catalan in to represent France, we can bring the Warriors in to represent New Zealand. You've then got four-nation competition. That suddenly has even more broadcast and sponsor appeal. But the key thing for me that I learnt this week was Shane Richardson's involvement, because I think we've got somebody who will even mean more in this country than he will in the NRL. We've got an expansionist and somebody who can tap into what's going on, particularly at Media City in Salford with the likes of Blake Solly and Mark Foster. And I think we've got somebody that's going to push the British game to be more and more involved in this type of competition.
Okay, Gold Coast and the cocaine scandal. How does it look from this distance to you?
It doesn't look great, but then it doesn't come as a huge surprise. I think I can't remember who it was that said that sport is a reflection of society, so you'd be foolish to think that we were immune from that kind of thing. I guess it's how the game handles it. The only thing I can compare it to in recent times over here was the Ben Flower punch in the grand final. I'm not comparing light with light, but that was an incident that could have been incredibly damaging for the sport over here. It was something that all the media focused on, that there wasn't anyone that didn't carry a story about it. But actually the way the sport handled it, and the way the two clubs came together to talk about the welfare of the players involved, we actually emerged with more credit than the incident itself. So I guess it's early days to see who is involved, where it all ends, and how it's going to be dealt with.
It is, and you know, there was a big danger with the original Asada issue of either understating or overstating it when we actually don't know anything. I mean, the legal representative for the players who've been charged so far says that they were phone tapped and they were talking about trafficking to themselves, supplying themselves, and they deny doing that. So, you know, the suggestion is, how do you get a conviction from someone saying they're going to take drugs? I mean, that is not indictable, so they're going to need a lot more evidence than that. I think it's really interesting working in the media, and I'm a defender of the media at almost every turn, or at least I think the media do a poor job. We do a poor job as an industry of explaining ourselves. We're happy to hold everyone else to account, and we're not happy to hold ourselves to account sometimes. But it's an interesting story. The media is staking out a former Broncos great, and that becomes a story. The media is staking him out. We can't name who he is, but if no charges are laid and nothing happens, then we're going to end up with this stain anyway. People will guess who it is. You know, I don't know how many people you would describe who still live in Brisbane who are former Broncos greats. It's not a huge list. So that's kind of, I'm a little bit dubious about the whole process there. We go and wait outside his house, then we report we're waiting outside his house.
Yep. It becomes self-perpetuating. I think the other thing is obviously social networking these days, that too often names are revealed on something like Twitter or all the various other Facebook, Instagram, and the danger is that isn't as controllable or regulatable as the media is. So I think, you know, yes, we want a fourth estate, we want to challenge authority. That's the reason why you go into this kind of thing in the first place. But I think you do acknowledge the fact that there are things like libel and slander laws, but there aren't out there on social networking. You've got to be very, very careful.
Speaking about Australia and recreational drugs, we've got an In Excess song in the background. But on that note, thanks for joining us, Phil.
It's a pleasure. And I don't know anything about music compared to you, but the very first time I was in Brisbane, I was taken to an In Excess concert in 1985 and absolutely loved it.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember where I was when poor old Michael died. Okay, a couple more housekeeping things. Firstly, go to iTunes and please make a comment, even a bad comment. Any comment is good. And secondly, if you go to wildlifefever.ning.com, there's a little button there that says donate. It's not free to do a podcast. It's free to talk into your phone, but it's not free to upload it. It's not free to host it. So any help there would be appreciated. And also, if you're doing any shopping, hit the Amazon button and we get a little kickback and you don't pay any more. Here's some music, some great new music. I reckon early favourite for album of the year. It's Sweet and Lynch from their album Only to Rise, and the song's called Dying Rose. And we'll be back with more rock interviews after that.
This is Jizzy Pearl here, hanging with Steve, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Okay, so welcome back to the program, and our next guest is Cormac Neeson from The Answer, and he is in... Where are you, Cormac? Where are you?
I am in sunny Belfast, man.
All right. And how is the weather?
It's pretty shitty. But it's kind of that time of the year, you know, we're used to it at this stage.
Yeah, yeah. Now, tell me, the album Raise a Little Hell, is it right, which is out in a couple of weeks, you went to Madrid? Was that just for the weather, to get away from the shitty weather? Or?
That was part of the reason, yeah. But the main reason was that our producer had just recently renovated his great-grandmother's home.
Right.
And turned it into a residential studio up in the mountains. It was kind of in a little village just north of Madrid. So he opened this great new studio and kind of held on to a lot of the old architecture. So it was vibey, you know, and we moved in. We lived there, slept there, ate there, drank there, and most importantly, made music there. But on top of all that, there was like the village annual fiesta. Yeah. It was just kicking off whenever we arrived, which meant bull runs in the morning, afternoon drinking, bull fights in the evening, and then lots more drinking. Just the whole town just kicked off. Like, I'm talking St. Patrick's Day drunk every day for a week.
How did you get to work, though?
What we would do is we'd head out in the morning, we'd watch the bull run, then we'd head back into the studio and work for 12 hours while the rest of the town just got steaming drunk. And then we'd go out and have a couple of beers in the evening and just laugh at the state some people had got themselves into. As I say, it was like St. Patrick's Day just every day for a week. It was fantastic. It just all fed, you know, the whole record experience. It was a lot of fun. And that whole kind of bull running festival just fed into the work that we were doing.
Was anyone connected to the recording or the band tempted to do the bull run? Or
our producer did it most mornings. Actually, he's as Spanish a man as you would ever meet. so he would do it, and we would kind of watch. I did it one morning actually. I'd watch Will do it on a number of occasions, and it got to the point where I was like, right, I'm doing this, you know. If I don't do it now, I'll never do it. So I did it. It was pretty crazy experience, actually. But as I say, it was all part of that, the party atmosphere in the town at the time.
Did you, I'm fascinated. Does a bull come close to you? What's the adrenaline like? Is it actually dangerous for most people?
So what happens is they'll have, I think it's five or six bulls ready to go, and they release one at a time. And they run like, can't remember what the name is for it, but it's like bullocks maybe, you know, whatever it is, the bull itself are attracted to these animals.
Right.
And they'll run these animals in front of the bull as kind of bait almost, you know, just to get the bull's blood pumping. And then he'll get let out of his trailer and just run at 90 mile an hour through the streets with like hundreds of crazy Spanish people running away from it, as you would imagine. But it's kind of down to you how close how close your starting distance is going to be.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations where if you're feeling brave, you can really, you know, get quite close to the bull, or alternatively you can give yourself a bit of space, you know. I mean, I generally played it safe. I didn't want to injure myself mid recording process. I would have been a first.
I was going to ask this question later, but it seems particularly relevant. To what extent does it sound a product of the place where it was recorded? I mean, and is this a product of where it was recorded?
Well, I think it sounds like we're having a really good time in there, which is absolutely the truth. You know, as I say, the whole party atmosphere fed into the recording process. Mm. And I think it was necessary for this record because it's essentially a good time rock and roll album. So, you know, you can't get in there and record this vibrant music if you're not enjoying yourself. But thankfully, we had a great time.
Now, I did say we're going to play a couple of songs. Can you remember any songs that were recorded or finished or started the day after you ran with the Bulls? Maybe we should start with that.
Long Live the Renegades kind of hits the nail on the head, I think, with that one.
Here
Hey folks, this is Cormac Neeson here from The Answer. Check out our new record, Raise a Little Hell. You're listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back to the program, and it's Northern Ireland week on White Line Fever because we had Cormac Neeson on earlier in the program from The Answer, and now we've got Ricky Warwick. How are you, Ricky?
I'm doing very good. I'm glad to see you, Cormac, on the show. He's a mate of mine. He's a good lad.
Awesome. But you're not in Northern Ireland now. You're in the States, aren't you?
I live in Los Angeles now. Yeah, sold my soul for the sun.
Yeah, exactly, because he was whinging about the weather. The Killer Instinct. I think we did actually speak to you in Nottingham about 18 months ago backstage, and I think at that point, Joe Elliott was. This is the new album for Black Star Riders, by the way. At that point, Joe Elliott was going to be producing it. I mean, how far along were you when he pulled out?
We were fairly well into it. I mean, we'd started writing. We hadn't really done any recording. We didn't do any recording with Joe, Damon and I, and we were kind of working on the songs. But he called us about May of last year, and just, you know, Def Leppard ended up doing the Kiss tour in the States, and they started writing for a new Def Leppard album, which had come together a lot quicker than they imagined. And what looked like was going to be a quiet year for Joe turned into a really, really busy year. And, you know, I've known Joe's a great friend of mine. He just said, look, I can't give you the guys the time to get involved in your album and do the justice that you guys deserve. And he said, I don't want to let you down. So, you know, that's the reason he pulled out of the album. It was really disappointing, you know, because he's a great guy and he's a friend, but also he's got a great studio. He's got a wealth of knowledge, and I think it'd have been a lot of fun to work with him. But, you know, in all honesty, it couldn't have turned out better in the end, if this truth be known, because we ended up working with the great Nick Rasklinich, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And that Kiss tour, did it also cost you your bass player? Because Dead Daisies were on that tour too, weren't they?
No comment. Listen, you know, Marco Mendoza is a great bass player, and Marco's the kind of guy that's got a lot of things on the go at one time. And with Black Star Riders, obviously, we were starting to tour more and more, the success of the first album, and we needed more of a commitment, and Marco just wasn't prepared, I think, to give us the commitment that we wanted, and he felt that he could. And he was pretty gracious. He said, look, guys, you know, we were on tour in the States, we finished this U.S. run, you know, I'm gonna leave the band, and he gave us plenty of time to find a replacement. Again, every cloud is silver lining because, you know, we got the incredible Robbie Crane in the band now, who's just fantastic. So I wish Marco all the best, you know.
So, Ricky, if you had have gone to the studio with Joe, it's a hard question, it's theoretical, I know, but do you think the record would have sounded a lot different?
Yeah, I think it would have. You know, I still think we would have made a great record. You know, I've recorded with Joe before on my solo records, and obviously, you know, I've heard the Leppard stuff that he's done in the studio. It would have had a different sound. I think the songs may have been different as well. One of the great things about working with Nick Rasklinich was he gets very, very involved in the pre-production and the arrangements. You know, we did a full week, full on of pre-production before we even recorded a note. And I think it would have, you know. I still think we'd have made a great album with Joe, but I think it would have been different, yeah.
Yeah, it continues on from the first record, which, and I don't think you take it as an insult that it sounds like a Thin Lizzy record. It's a compliment, and it's the same.
Sure.
It continues in the same vibe in a really positive way. I'm sure other people ask this, do you go back and listen to Thin Lizzy records when you're in the studio?
No.
Right.
No, I mean, I listen to Thin Lizzy. I grew up listening to Thin Lizzy. Thin Lizzy are, you know, one of my favorite bands of all time. You know, obviously being Irish, they just were, and they're such a great band. Phil Lynott, to me, is one of probably the best frontman in the history of rock and roll, in my opinion. I always listened to Lizzy, even when I was in Thin Lizzy. I would listen to Lizzy. There's the answer to your question. It's part of who we are. I mean, you got Scott Gorham, who's an integral part of that Thin Lizzy sound, that guitar sound that you know, you heard in all those great classic Lizzy tracks with Scott and Rob or Gary Moore. You know, Scott was an integral part of that. That's who he is. Scott has got that style. So when we've got Scott in the band, so we're going to have that. Plus Damon Johnson and myself, you know, when in Thin Lizzy I was there for 4 years, Damon was there for 3 years. And part of that's ingrained in who we are and that style. And we're certainly, it's the spirit of Thin Lizzy that we want to retain. while forging ahead and getting our own identity as well. I think we've managed to, you know, keep one foot on either side of that line, you know.
Okay, we'll be back speaking to you in the next program, but from the point of view of the listeners, so can we have a song to finish this show and to finish the first segment of our interview? What would you like us to play?
You want a Black Star Riders song?
Well, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Your call.
Yeah, no, that'll be great to have a Black Star Riders song off a new album. How about the track Soldier's Town?
There's a stranger on the road tonight on the way to Soldier's Town. A stranger with his coat pulled tight, his collar buttoned down. A stranger every sinner knows, a seasoned man of war. Marching to the fires of hell, skied by the kiln. Soldier's Town, it's written on the moon. They're pulling all the shutters down, listen fearful of his tune. He'll sing a song of sixpence, break his fist upon a door. They know the score in Soldier's Town, he's done it here before. There is no choice, no compromise, give up one of your kin to save the other children, to save your bone and skin. Tonight's the night you must decide what souls they'll go. The devil rides in Soldier's Town, his boots cut through the snow.
Thank you. I got a white line fever. Going to run land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. And I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. And you get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever. Rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.